Welcome, everybody, to Free Brew Books, and welcome to our Books Through Bars benefit and the Brooklyn book launch for The Hidden 70s, Histories of Radicalism, edited by Dan Berger. And we're going to have speakers today, Vicky Law and Andy Cornell, and also Matt Meyer, who's running late, as well as Dan. So thanks very much for coming. I'm going to give a brief intro to Books Through Bars for folks who might be new. Books Through Bars is a group that sends free books to people in prison. The books are donated by members of the community and publishers we solicit and other folks we ask for free books. All the volunteers are the staff, and so labor's donated and space is donated. I want to give a very special shout out to Peter, who is our he runs the bookstore, Free Brew Books, that we're in, and hope everybody gets a chance to look around and appreciate that tonight. We moved here about 6 months ago. We had been staying at the New York City AIDS Housing Network for 4 years, and they housed us for a long time, also for free. If anyone's ever tried to look for a free place to put their community organization in New York City, you know how tricky it is. And we spent a long time looking for a new space to be last winter. And Peter came through for us, and we moved into this basement and tidied it up with him, and it was really amazing. So sometimes I forget to say this when we have events, but thank you so much, Peter, for giving us a space to be, not only to have a pack-in session like we have downstairs, and we'll do a tour later, but to do events like this. He even helps us promote stuff, so Peter's totally involved, and it's wonderful, so thank you. Anyway, so Books Through Bars sends free books to people in prison, and our only expense is postage money. So for that reason, it's not just an organization that gets together to support prisoners by sending them free literature. It's also an organization that does both consciousness-raising and fundraising events. And tonight is both. Tonight's more a consciousness-raising than a fundraising event. And we get together three nights a week in this basement. We can use the help of people who want to pack books for us. We can use the help of people who want to set up a Dropbox for us in Brooklyn or Manhattan or elsewhere. We can use the help of folks who want to help us organize fundraisers. So if you want to get in touch, talk to somebody here, or check out our brand new website that was put together by two of our members recently. So really happy to present The Hidden 70s tonight, the Brooklyn launch of this new collection published by Rutgers University Press. And was especially happy to hear that there was a new book coming up by Dan, because I loved his collection about the Weather Underground, the definitive book about the Weather Underground. And it's, I think, sometimes true that even folks who are tuned in to what's happening in the radical scene today have sometimes a very poor sense of history. We are affected by a lot of the same stereotypes and mass media-fed stuff about what the 1960s and 70s were like. And so sort of constant looking back and trying to widen our perspective is necessary. So I am really looking forward to reading this new book. So I'm going to start by passing it over to Dan. Thanks very much. Oh, actually, I'm going to start by passing the can. Books Through Bars, because this is a benefit, like we were saying. So thank you.
Maybe while everyone is passing and doing things, I'll pass around these postcards for the Freedom Dance, which is a party and also a celebration of the life of Marilyn Buck. For folks who don't know, Marilyn was a political prisoner for more than 25 years who got out of prison in July and had very advanced cancer and unfortunately passed away in August. But a long-time revolutionary, anti-racist, feminist, poet, translator, and really wonderful person. So and friend. So that's an event that's coming up in a couple of weeks, and there's a lot more cards if you want to take some to give to other folks or leave elsewhere. That would be great. Hi, it's really great to be here. Bookstore is amazing and so exciting that it's the home of Books Through Bars. We actually, Andy and I brought books to sell, so if you're interested in buying a copy, and I hope that you are, we have those available, and some of the money, all of the sort of proceeds from that after paying for costs will go through Books Through Bars, so that will be an extra way you can support Books Through Bars tonight. I don't want to talk too much about the collection overall. There's a lot of stuff in there, but I do want to, or even talk too much about the 70s overall, but I do want to really just focus on our topic for tonight, which is prison in the 70s and learning from prison organizing in the 70s. And Andy and Vicky and Matt, who will hopefully be joining us, all have a lot to say based on their contributions to the book and their years of organizing around that subject as well. And I'm going to try to be brief, because I think the conversation that we'll have will be the most interesting aspect of it, but also because in addition to editing this book for the past 4 years, I've also been writing a dissertation all about Black and Puerto Rican prison organizing in the 70s for the past several years as well, which I just finished, but I feel very enmeshed in that world, and so I'll try to be brief rather than very long and recap my 500-page dissertation for you tonight. So just a few things that I want to say to get us started, and then Vicky will talk about her chapter and Andy will talk about his. I think, you know, the prison touches all aspects of radicalism in the 70s, at least almost all aspects of the 1970s. And this isn't that surprising, right? But it's really interesting because mass incarceration began in the 70s, right? The current sort of crisis of incarceration that we're dealing with began in the 70s, and the whole campaign and politics of law and order has its roots then. But it was developing, right? It was sort of beginning to emerge, and so it didn't have the same support, finances, resources, personnel that we have now, right? Or that we've been fighting and dealing with for the past, for all of my lifetime, 20 past 30 years. And so it's interesting that the prison was such a politicized and contested site in the time period before and coinciding with the rise of mass incarceration, right? It was some of the most dramatic organizing around prisons, rather than in the 80s and 90s, where there was still a lot of organizing happening, but it was a lot more scattered and disconnected. Whereas in the 70s, you had something that sort of self-consciously referred to itself as a prison movement. Right? And the prison movement, and there's a chapter, the first chapter of the book chronicles the prison movement, especially as the sort of roots of prison abolition, right? Which organizations like Critical Resistance and Insight Women of Color Against Violence have been organizing for the past 10 years or so, but an author and organizer, Liz Samuel, sort of traces the origins of that to a variety of organizing efforts in the 70s. And this, the early prison movement and the early prison abolition movement was a multiracial and quite militant and often quite visionary movement that was organized under the sort of leadership of Black power, right? And primarily concerned with Black male prisoners, but in different moments rather successful at bringing together a wide variety of people and movements, right, even within, or sort of especially within, a Black power framework. And this is one of the few arenas that Black power and multiracial organizing coexisted. Not, I won't say with ease, right, but with a lot of regularity around shared work, supporting different prisoners, and working to have a moratorium on prison construction. Right, this is an area where revolutionary nationalists and white pacifists really had a lot of agreement and solidarity and shared work. Right, and some of that shared work included the institutionalization in the beginning of things like Books Through Bars. I don't know the sort of history of the New York chapter specifically, but lots of organizations really noticed how important literature was in the consciousness of organizing inside, right? And that was obviously helped by the rise of various prison authors like Eldridge Cleaver and George Jackson in particular, although many others. right? And so people started really institutionalizing sending books for free to prisoners, newspapers, magazines. You know, lots of organizations sent things in for free. And this was, you know, was part of a general tenor of service on behalf of and in solidarity with prisoners, right? And a lot of that service started with the most, you know, radical, revolutionary of intentions. Much of it stayed there, but a lot of it was either co-opted or destroyed as the calls for law and order picked up steam, picked up support, and eliminated a lot of the resources that people had to send materials in for free. I was looking just today in some archives in Manhattan and seeing an early Books to Prisoners program that that was ultimately destroyed. So there's just a few examples that I want to hold up that are talked about in the book and also in my dissertation as part of sort of prison organizing in the 70s and some of the, I think, innovations or interesting things about it. The first is an organization called the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Has anyone heard of that group? So that was an organization that came out of the Free Angela Davis movement or committee. And I think it's worth saying that, you know, we as radicals or revolutionaries or progressive people, whatever, however you want to talk about it, have had a lot more success keeping people out of prison than getting them out of prison. And Angela Davis is a really good example of that. So folks probably know Angela Davis, the black communist professor who first came to public light when an FBI informant sort of outed her as a communist teaching at the University of California system, caused a big controversy by the governor, a man named Ronald Reagan, who fired her, and the Communist Party and the ACLU and others sort of defending her right to speak. A year later, she became very involved in the defense work around George Jackson, who was a black prisoner at that time at Soledad Prison, also outside of the Bay Area. And later became famous as the author of Soledad Brother, a collection of his letters from prison. But Angela Davis was very involved in the defense work, was a leader of the Soledad Brother Support Committee. She became very close with George's younger brother, Jonathan. And in August of 1970, Jonathan raided the Marin County Courthouse with several guns and took the judge and the district attorney and several jurors hostage, and armed three prisoners who were on trial that day. George Jackson was not in court that day. And the San Quentin security guards, or prison guards, came and opened fire on the group as they were leaving, killing Jonathan Jackson and two of the three prisoners that he had with him, as well as the judge, and paralyzing the district attorney. Angela Davis was arrested for, because the guns that Jonathan Jackson used, two of them were registered in her name. And she was charged with conspiracy, and the prosecutor had this very elaborate, misogynist sort of tale that Angela was driven by her passion to George to sacrifice his younger brother, and a really twisted tale. And it went on for 2 years, and she was acquitted in 1972. And it was a massive defense effort that was orchestrated in large part by the Communist Party, which Angela was at that time a member, but really pulled in a wide variety of support, both from the sort of socialist bloc, right, and various groups throughout Eastern Europe came to her defense with lots of public statements and petitions and protests and money. But also in the U.S., lots of unions and black religious groups, a church group called the Council on Church and Race within the Presbyterian Church gave $10,000 to her defense right away. Right? So again, a really fascinating merger of faith-based communities, religious communities, both black and white, with revolutionary black nationalists and communists of all different racial and national backgrounds, right? And that was a tremendous success in her victory in keeping her out of prison. After they won, a few months after they won, the sort of leaders of the Free Angela Davis Committee, or the National United Committee to Free Angela Davis, began the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. And this was an organization with a similar agenda, which was to bring together a variety of political and civil rights organizations, faith-based organizations, in support of people facing racist and political repression. They were involved in some of the prison moratorium efforts. They tried to take a stand against the barrage of law and order policies that started coming in the mid to late 70s. Everything from behavior modification inside prisons to control units in prisons to all of the changes in the sort of legal code that made it easier for the state to lock more and more people up. And, you know, the Communist Party always had a strong role in the National Alliance, but it was never a CP project, right? Ann Braden, veteran civil rights organizer from Kentucky, was on the board. Lots of people were really involved, right? And so that's one sort of fascinating organization from the 70s. They were sort of more focused, I think, on the sort of policy level and, again, on keeping people out of prison. They were very involved in the defense of the Wilmington 10, who were civil rights activists in North Carolina, who were facing jail time after a riot in 1972, I believe. Right? And the Wilmington 10 was one of the sort of primary goals of the primary organizing campaign to the National Alliance, which ultimately proved successful. Right? But they did less on working with people who were in prison and more on prison conditions and people facing time in prison. So the next organization I want to talk about is a group called the Republic of New Africa, which was a black nationalist organization founded in Detroit in 1968 that talked about the black population in the U.S. as sort of a new political subject, right? The new African was an identity formed as a result of slavery and Jim Crow, right? And they held that the five states of the Black Belt South, Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, Louisiana, and Alabama, constituted the territory of the black nation, right? These were the states that slaves had built, and so that was the sort of land that the RNA was demanding. They moved to Mississippi in 1970 and really sort of fought for that as their land. And in 1971, 3 days before George Jackson was murdered in prison, the FBI raided two RNA homes and arrested 11 people in a shootout. Arrested 7 people in a shootout and arrested 4 people quietly. Right? And the RNA 11 campaign became another huge sort of defense effort. They were all convicted, but the RNA was able to get everyone out within 10 years. And this was a massive organizing campaign that involved a lot of international support. And, you know, because the RNA really took itself seriously as the black nation within the U.S., they tried to negotiate and have a sort of international relations policy, reaching out to Fidel Castro and the Soviet Union and Tanzania and all, you know, China and many other countries, right, and trying to sort of argue that they were not just political prisoners, but prisoners of war in the United States. This was a position that some other black revolutionaries had used, but the RNA had a lot more sort of support in trying to make that happen. And the RNA also tapped into the remaining revolutionary fervor among black prisoners throughout the country, right? And their notion of a black nation captive within the United States really appealed to a lot of black radical prisoners who were trying to understand and explain their own sense of fight, you know, battles with white supremacy that led them to whatever conditions that led to their imprisonment. So the RNA as a sort of idea was even more successful than the RNA as an organization in leading these campaigns for international redress. The National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, along with some New African prisoners submitted petitions to the United Nations trying to get some manner of redress for black prisoners and call attention to the growing crisis of black imprisonment and imprisonment in general, even leading to a particularly embarrassing moment for Andrew Young, who's a former civil rights activist who worked closely with Martin Luther King, but then was appointed the first black representative to the United Nations from the United States. And a journalist in Paris asked him if, you know, if there were political prisoners in the U.S., and he said that there were hundreds, maybe thousands of people that he would consider political prisoners in the U.S. And this was a very big crisis, particularly in the days of the Cold War, that ultimately, a couple other blunders later, led to his forced removal from that post. But that came, that those conditions were created in part by the various petitions that black prisoners, many of them associated with the Republic of New Africa, initiated at the international level in the late 1970s. And the last one that I want to talk about for now is from the Puerto Rican independence movement. And in the 1970s, the Puerto Rican independence movement started to turn toward prisons, particularly as a result of five nationalist political prisoners that have been in prison since the 1950s. One of them had shot at President Truman as part of, in response to the U.S. crushing a revolt in Puerto Rico in 1950, and four of them had shot at the ceiling in the House of Representatives in Congress in 1954 to call attention to the ongoing colonization of Puerto Rico. And, you know, their trials were big deals, but they were largely forgotten about by the end of the 50s. And in the 1970s, with a rising independence movement within the U.S. as well as on the island, their symbols, their figures, their cases were sort of resurrected within the movement. Right? And there were massive campaigns on behalf of the nationalists. This was another thing that you can find throughout, you know, all of the work that the National Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression was, calls to free the five nationalists, right? I was just talking the other day to this white working class woman who grew up in Kensington, which is a working class section of Philadelphia. Her first protest was going to this massive rally at Madison Square Garden in 1974, 20,000 people, in which the demand around the freedom of the nationalists was central. Right? This was something that really everyone on the left in the 1970s was really organizing around, or at least aware and supportive of. And one of the things that it generated was, not just that campaign, but the independence movement in general at that time, was an armed clandestine group called the FALN, which in English is the Armed Forces of National Liberation. And of all of the armed revolutionary groups of the time, the FALN was perhaps the most active. It carried out more than 100 bombings between 1974 and 1983. And until the nationalists were released in 1979, their freedom was a really central demand in all of their communiques and all of their actions, right? And it got to the point where the Carter administration was considering negotiating a prisoner exchange with Fidel Castro. Right? That this had become such a sort of global crisis. And indeed, after the nationalists were released in 1979, Cuba quietly released four Americans who had been held in Cuba for many years, which was seen not as a prisoner exchange, but as a gesture, right? That the U.S. had a gesture by letting the nationalists go, and so Cuba would respond with a gesture. Right? And I think part of the Puerto Rican success, again, lay with the sense of internationalism, but I think even more than the others, in the Puerto Rican example, they were able to blend a deep community roots, particularly in Chicago and here in New York, which, not surprisingly, were the biggest places and the places with the highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans in the U.S. And those deep community roots carried over across a variety of alternative institutions like schools and community centers that organizers had built, but also blended with a high degree of militancy. So in 1977, organizers in Chicago took over the Statue of Liberty for a day, right, and draped a Puerto Rican flag over the eyes of the Statue of Liberty. And again, the demand for the freedom of the nationalists was at the top of their agenda. Right? And so it was this sort of combination of community organizing and sort of dramatic acts that called attention to the ongoing crisis of either the prison writ large or at least particular prisoners within it, but I think also combined with a strong sense of international appeal. Right? In all of these examples, although most successfully in the Puerto Rican example, the case of the prisoners was taken up in front of international bodies, right, the UN in particular, and calls for decolonization where the prisoners were seen as prime examples of ongoing colonialism and white supremacy within the United States. And the other thing, and then I'll stop here, that happened that I think is worth mentioning, if only for historical accuracy, is prison breaks, because this was also a part of the movement in the 1970s. And at the end of the decade, there were two fairly high-profile prison breaks, one from Asada Shakur, a former Black Panther, Black Liberation Army member who escaped in November of 1979 and ultimately took up residence in Cuba, and William Guillermo Morales, who was the first person arrested for the FALN. He was arrested after he was making a bomb and it exploded and he lost most of both of his hands. And then at a prison hospital in New York, he climbed out the window with bed sheets that were tied together and ultimately escaped to Mexico, and was in Mexico for several years, and Mexico refused to extradite him to the U.S., causing a big international scandal, and he now is in Cuba as well. When he escaped, Juan Antonio Corajer, who's one of the leaders of the island-based independence movement, called Morales a handless hero who slapped the face of God. So there was some, degree of joy, or even poetry at these high-profile escapes, but they were also in 1979 at the dawn of Reagan's massive electoral victory, at which law and order played a pivotal role, and then subsequently gave rise to the war on drugs that has really given this giant boost in mass incarceration. So I don't mean these examples as sort of rosy ahistorical ones to deny what's happened since, but rather to show the sort of enormous changes that are possible even in what seem like the most unlikely of circumstances. So, I'm going to shut up and turn it over to Vicky.
I'm going to stand up, because I feel like I'm sinking into the chair, kind of like nice. After Alice in Wonderland, like, eats the cookie, it looks gross. Where am I supposed to Okay. Can I hand you this? Because I will pace back and forth, and I'm going to knock it over. And right. Hey, everybody. So I like to start talking by asking questions. I'm not going to ask you about Attica tonight, for those of you who have seen me. But just by a show of hands, how many of you have heard of Yvonne Wanroe?
Should I not raise my hand?
It doesn't count if you've edited my face. How many of you have heard of Inez Garcia? Joanne Little? Okay. Jenna Kelsey? Barbara Gilbert? Beverly Ben-Tomas? Kathy Thomas? Okay, so all seven of these women were not necessarily political. They were incarcerated for defending themselves against assault in the 1970s, and only three of them received an outpouring of support from people on the left, on the radical left, and from community groups, which eventually got them freed. But all of them were in the 1970s defending themselves, and were arrested and incarcerated for this. So I'm going to start with Yvonne Wanroe, and this is going to, all of these are brief summaries. There are like more nuances, but I will be here all night if I tell you all the nuances of each case. So these are just brief summaries, and you can like flip through the book and find out the whole story about each. In 1972, Yvonne Wanroe was a Colville Indian and a mother of two living in Spokane, Washington. In August of 1972, her 11-year-old son was riding his bike down the street, and he was grabbed by a man named William Wessler, who was a known child molester in the neighborhood. He escaped William Wessler and fled to the house of a family friend named Shirley Hooper, and Wessler followed him. When Wessler came to the door, Shirley Hooper's daughter, seven-year-old daughter who had been raped earlier that year and contracted an STD as a result, saw Wessler and said to her mother, "That's the man that did it to me." Understandably upset, Shirley Hooper called the police. They came over, and even though they had arrested William Wessler several times before for child molestation, and even had nicknamed him Chicken Bill, they basically refused to do anything. They said, wait until after the weekend, and you can file a complaint to the precinct. Shaken by this, Shirley Hooper called Yvonne Wanrow and asked her if she would come and spend the night at her house, because she was afraid to be at home by herself with the two children. Yvonne Wanrow, who is 5'4" and had recently broken her leg, came, and she brought her pistol. At 5 in the morning, William Wessler entered Shirley Hooper's house, and he ignored the women's demands that he get out. Yvonne Wanrow went to the front door to yell for help, and when she turned around, Wessler, who was about 6'2", and keep in mind that Yvonne Wanrow was 5'4" and had recently broken her leg, was towering over her, and she shot and killed him. She was arrested and charged with his murder. At the trial, the judge instructed the jury only to consider what had happened either at or immediately before the killing, which left out Wessler's record as a known child molester, his assault on Hooper's 7-year-old daughter earlier that year, and his attempted assault on Yvonne's son earlier that afternoon. So without any of these mitigating facts, the jury convicted Yvonne Wanrow of murder and sentenced her to 25 years. So this would have been the end of it, except that different groups in the women's movement and the American Indian movements took up her cause and recognized that she had a right to defend herself and her children against this man's assault, even if it meant that she shot the man. And so they held events that raised awareness about the issue, that educated the public about her case, and tied it into cases of systemic violence against women and against Native peoples in the U.S. So they were politicizing this case, which would have been just a personal self-defense case, into something more political and tied it into the political issues of the day. And they also raised funds for her legal defense so that she wasn't relying on a court-appointed lawyer who could care less about her case. And because of this, in 1977, the Washington State Supreme Court granted Yvonne Wanrow a new trial, partially on the basis that the jury should have considered all the relevant facts when considering her plea for self-defense, not just what had immediately happened in that half hour before the killing. And in 1979, Yvonne Wanrow had a new trial, and she pled guilty to greatly reduced charges and received a suspended sentence, 5 years probation, and 1 year of community service, instead of having to serve 25 years in prison. And all of this happened because she received a huge outpouring of support from different groups and different communities on the left. 2 years later, there was a woman named Inez Garcia who was living in California with a roommate. Two men entered their home and threatened her roommate, and then took her outside to an alleyway where one of them raped her, while the other one, who weighed 300 pounds, blocked the only exit so that she couldn't escape. They left, and then they called her up and they threatened her with further harm. So she took her gun and she went out looking for them. And when she found them, she shot and killed the man who had blocked her escape. And she was arrested and charged with first degree or premeditated murder. Again, like Yvonne Wanrow, her cause was taken up by the women's movement. It was taken up by various other groups. The Black Panther Party came out in support of her. Elaine Brown, who was acting chair of the Black Panther Party at the time, actually spoke at a press conference and said that the Black Panther Party understood a woman's right to defend herself against assault. And this made the news. It drew media attention. It drew more public support to her. And even after she was convicted, after a circus of a trial in which the judge did not allow testimony about the rape to happen, and one of the jurors even said later, after convicting Inez Garcia, that you couldn't kill somebody for trying to give you a good time, the women's movement continued to rally around her cause. They tried to petition the governor for her release. They continued to raise money, and they hired a feminist attorney named Susan Jordan to appeal the case. And Susan Jordan appealed the case, and in 1976, after Inez Garcia had spent 2 years in prison, the California Court of Appeals reversed her conviction, specifically because the trial judge had instructed the jury to ignore the rape when considering a plea of self-defense. Again, so the trial judge was basically saying, she went out looking for this man, and that's all you have to know. We're not going to consider any of the things that happened before, the immediate circumstances. And during the retrial, Susan Jordan actually made the rape an integral part of the case. So she started by questioning potential jurors about their preconceptions of rape. So she questioned jurors about how they would feel if they were raped, or if one of their female relatives were raped, or their loved ones were raped. And she really put that idea in their mind that this was a case about Inez Garcia's sexual assault, and the fact that she was defending herself against threats of further harm. And as a result, Inez Garcia was acquitted. The entire jury agreed that the rape and the threat of further harm were adequate provocation for Garcia's actions. And it also established a legal precedent that extended this interpretation of imminent harm to beyond just the immediate circumstances, and it laid the groundwork for what later became known as the battered women's defense, which is that a woman who kills her abuser is acting in self-defense even if she's not being attacked at that time. So this was a groundbreaking case for, you know, for women all over and for self-defense cases. That same year, in August in North Carolina, there was a 21-year-old black woman named Joanne Little, who was the only female prisoner in the Beaufort County Jail. A 62-year-old white male guard named Clarence Alligood entered her cell with an ice pick, threatened her, and forced her to perform oral sex on him. She stabbed him to death with the ice pick and then fled, and she turned herself in 8 days later. She was charged with first-degree murder, which in North Carolina carries a mandatory death sentence. But like Inez Garcia and Yvonne Juanro's cases, there was a huge outpouring of support from various movements, including people and groups in the Women's Liberation Movement, the Black Liberation Movement, community groups. I found evidence that, like, church groups held chicken dinners to raise money on her behalf. People really took up this cause that she had the right to defend herself against being sexually assaulted. And because she had so much support, she was able to get a better defense team. And during her trial, her defense team exposed the chronic sexual abuse and harassment that was endured by women in the jail and prison system in North Carolina. The prosecution argued that Joanne Little had enticed Clarence Alligood into her cell and then killed him. And they countered this by calling in women who had been held at the Beaufort County Jail, who testified that Alligood had a history of sexually abusing women in his custody. One woman stated that he had fondled her breasts while bringing her a late-night sandwich. Another recalled that he had suggested that she had been in jail long enough to need a man. Little herself testified that Alligood had come to her cell three times that night before showing up with the ice pick. After she refused his advances twice, he returned with the ice pick and she said, "By then, I changed into my nightgown. He was telling me I really looked nice in my gown, and he wanted to have sex with me. He said he had been nice to me, and it was time I was nice to him. I told him I didn't feel like I should be nice to him that way." After only 78 minutes of deliberation, a jury acquitted Joanne Little, again establishing a precedent for killing as a justified self-defense against sexual assault. So all three of these cases happened in the 1970s, and in all three of these cases, the women killed somebody in self-defense, and there was a huge outpouring of support from different groups on the left and different community groups that understood that women had a right to defend themselves, or in the case of Yvonne Juanro, their families against assault or sexual assault. However, this same type of support didn't extend to all women who defended themselves. In 1973, the same year that Yvonne Juanro was first convicted for killing William Wessler, there was a woman named Jenna Kelsey who shot and killed her ex-husband while he was beating her. Despite his history of abuse, which included a nearly fatal incident in which he drove her car off the road with his truck, a jury found Jenna Kelsey guilty of second-degree murder. And 2 years later, after exhausting all of her requests for an appeal, she began serving a 15 to 25-year sentence. There was no mass movement that emerged to support her, no support groups, no mass attention paid to her case. Basically, like, you know, she went to court, she was found guilty, she exhausted her appeals, she served 15 to 25 years. In Maryland that same year, a woman named Barbara Jean Gilbert killed her husband after 17 years of enduring his abuse. She was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Lacking movement support, she nonetheless appealed her conviction and was granted a new trial, and was then convicted of manslaughter. The prosecuting attorney did not ask for a prison sentence. The parole and probation board actually recommended probation instead of a prison sentence, but the judge took it upon himself to sentence Barbara Gilbert to 8 years, which was the maximum penalty that he could for manslaughter, stating, "You have inflicted pain and deprivation. You have snuffed out a life. Therefore, the court has the right to inflict pain and deprivation on you." And in these cases, and many others in which abused women kill their batterers, there was no mass movement that emerged to either draw attention to these women or to help them with better legal assistance, which reflected a silence among the more radical movements and more radical groups around the issue of abuse and battering. And if we're talking about what can we learn from this, we can see that we have some of these same silences today. At the time, however, it's not as if these issues weren't becoming more widely publicized. In 1977, a study from Chicago's Cook County Jail was widely reported. So it was in the New York Times, it was in the Chicago Tribune, it was in all these papers and magazines that basically found that over 40% of the women charged with murdering their partners had been physically attacked repeatedly by these men. So it wasn't like women were just deciding to, like, kill their male partners, you know, on a whim or because they were psycho. There was an actual pattern of abuse that they were fighting back against. This same study showed that each of these women had called police at least five times, and that many had already separated from these men in attempts to escape the abuse. Again, however, no mass movements emerged to support these and other battered women, and there was this idea that battered women were at fault for staying or for not escaping their abusers, and that's an idea that continues to persist today. However, towards the end of the decade, some in the women's movement were recognizing the need to support battered women, and this recognition started to extend to people who weren't necessarily considering themselves radical or looking for alternatives to state-sponsored systems. So there were more resources for battered women that were developed. And by 1982, the number of battered women shelters was estimated to be between 300 to 700. There were a number of hotlines for battered women established. There were a number of support groups. And keep in mind that while these resources began to exist, it didn't decrease the number of men who killed their female partners. However, the number of women who killed their male partners decreased by more than 25%. So these resources actually meant that women were finding ways to get out of these situations without having to resort to killing their partners to escape. But it didn't mean that men were saying like, oh, I guess I shouldn't beat my loved one, you know, to the point where I kill her. So it didn't actually change like the system of violence that we have, or this idea that certain people in our society can be beat, you know, and it's okay to actually have violence inflicted on them. Having more people involved and aware of battered women's issues also resulted in a watering down of the analysis around battering. So rather than questioning why it always is that it's the women and children that get beaten up in a relationship, people were basically looking at domestic violence as a personal issue. This also resulted in Susan Jordan's groundbreaking argument around the Inez Garcia case, around imminent harm extending beyond the immediate time period, to becoming something known as battered women syndrome, which basically states that an abused woman learns to be helpless and can't escape her abuser. And this kind of defense left out women who didn't fit the stereotype of submissive, quiet, middle-class white mothers and wives. So basically anybody who is a woman of color, who is poor, who might be loud, who might not fit any of these preconceived stereotypes of what a good wife should look like was left out of this. And this was true in the case of both Beverly Eben Tomas, who was a black Muslim woman who killed her abusive husband in 1979, and Kathy Thomas, who was a welfare recipient and occasional drug user who killed her her drug dealer boyfriend after he had threatened both her and her small child. In both cases, the courts actually denied their defense of battered women syndrome because they didn't fit this stereotype of what a battered woman should look like. So we can see that the battered woman syndrome got twisted to uphold these patriarchal ideas of femininity, class, and race, and was only used in some instances. Also, with the watering down of this analysis around battering, there was a shift in focus towards relying on the state to deal with abuse and battering through mandatory arrests and harsher sentencing. So we can see in the 1980s, women's groups coming out more and more to say, like, you know, like, there should be harsher sentences towards women, towards men who beat their wives. There should be harsher sentences for men who kill their wives. Not, we need to develop these systems in which people are not enabled to abuse other people. Many women of color and radical feminists questioned this shift within the battered women's movement and argued that these shifts towards more policing, more prisons, more sentencing targeted poor people and communities of color disproportionately. And when these concerns weren't addressed, many of these women left the larger and the more mainstream battered women's movement to work in their own communities. At the same time, however, many of the non-women-centered radical movements and groups weren't addressing battering and abuse at all, so there wasn't necessarily a different analysis or set of solutions coming from these groups either. And Dan mentioned the Republic of New Africa, and I actually talked to a woman who had been active in the Republic of New Africa doing work around Joanne Little as a teenager in the case of another woman named Dessie Woods as part of the Republic of New Africa. And I asked her why there was such a silence around battering and abuse at the time and why these same groups weren't coming out in support of battered women who killed their abusers. And she said, "The battered women's movement has done a significant amount of work to make violence, especially domestic violence, a political issue and a social issue as opposed to a personal issue. But then that wasn't happening. And so it was kind of like, that's not something we can take on, that's not something we can get involved with, that's a personal situation, and so we can't deal with it." And that was basically the attitude of a lot of these groups, so there wasn't any sort of analysis going on around that. So the implication was that you could either put up with this battering and be quiet about it, or you could rely on the state to come and, like, you know, lock your abuser up. So what can we learn today from these examples? We can see that if we're not addressing the fact that we live in a society that condones gendered violence and violence among people who are the most vulnerable, and we're not coming up with our own solutions, then the fallback becomes either putting up with it or relying on prisons and policing to keep women and other vulnerable people safe. And we can also see that it's imperative to support women who are incarcerated for killing their abusers, as well as women, especially those in our own communities, in our own neighborhoods, in our own groups, who are being abused, because abuse isolates people. So people are afraid to speak out, and they don't feel like they have any other resources. And we have to recognize that these two are connected, and we should be working on both fronts to end violence against women without strengthening government control over our lives or promoting incarceration as a solution to these social problems. Thank you.
Hey everyone, how are you? My name is Andy Cornell. I want to thank Books Through Bars for inviting us here to talk, and also just for the important work that they do. I was involved with the Books Through Bars project for a little while, a number of years ago in Philadelphia, and I recognize how much work it is and kind of how much responsibility it is because of the way that prisoners really come to depend on the packages they receive and how much they appreciate it, how transformative it can be in their lives. I saw that in reading some of the letters that came to the Philadelphia Books Through Bars. I think people who work on those projects are often underappreciated, so I wanted to say thank you, and I think it's really important work that you all do. So I also wanted to say thanks to Dan and to Vicky for inviting me to share this panel with them, and Dan for putting the book together and giving me a place to tell my story, the story in it that I wrote about. I'm happy because I think my chapter... Oops, wait a second. I'm happy because I think my chapter allows us to think about a couple different moments. Hey, Matt. A couple different moments where prison... Or, I'll just wait a second, let Matt slide. My chapter is about a group called Movement for a New Society. I think it's called Movement for a New Society, Prefiguration, Consensus, Direct Action, or some combination of those words. And as I was saying, I'm happy because I think the experience of Movement for a New Society allows me to talk about a couple moments historically where, oddly enough, the experience of being incarcerated was really politically productive and even in a sense empowering for a number of radical activists. So let me say just a minute about how I came to write this chapter about this group. And then I want to say a few things about the group briefly. And then I just want to talk about these two moments that are important in the historical trajectory of that group and how it came to be that the experience of being locked up was really politically invigorating. I decided to write about this group as part of a bigger project, which was to try and figure out the history of anarchism in the United States in the 20th century. And I decided I wanted to embark on that project kind of earlier in this decade when it seemed like the fortunes of anarchist movements were really on the rise and on the uptick after Seattle and all these other large convergences around these kind of international economic organization summits. And it seemed like with all the journalism and even some academic writing about this kind of the new anarchists and this kind of new upsurge in anarchist activism, very few people had any sense of where it came from and how all the kind of aspects of anarchist politics that were becoming really visible at that time developed and where they came from. So we had these histories that ended with Emma Goldman being deported in World War I, and then it jumped up to this moment of Seattle. And you're very different groups of people, right? You have this kind of immigrant, working class,
group of anarchists that are focused on class politics, on the workplace, and then in this next kind of moment of where anarchists were highlighted, it's more youth, middle class, white folks. They're talking about feminism, they're talking about cultural alienation, they're talking about ecology. And some of the things that were most definitive about them were about how they did their organizing. There's this idea of we're going to use spokes councils to coordinate these massive nonviolent direct actions. In those spokes council meetings, we're going to use the consensus decision-making process. There are things that hold us all together here. At the Convergence Center, where everyone's coming together to shut down the WTO meeting or whatever it is, there's only going to be vegetarian food there. A lot of us have a similar way of dressing that is expressive of our resistance to the state, to capitalism, to racism. So where did all this stuff come from? What happened, you know, over that kind of 80 or so year history? I'm certainly not going to talk about all that right now. But what's interesting, I think, is that this group, Movement for a New Society, which I wrote about, was kind of a key player in that. Even though most people, hardly anyone in the kind of general population, has ever heard of Movement for a New Society, and I would suspect many anarchists today have never heard of Movement for a New Society. So let me say a couple things about them. And then kind of backtrack that history a little bit more. This group, Movement for a New Society, was formed in 1971 in Philadelphia, and they were always strongest and had the most people in Philadelphia. A lot of them settled in a specific neighborhood of West Philadelphia, where today you still see a lot of kind of radical political activity. There's the A Space, which is an anarchist community center, which houses the Books Through Bars program of Philadelphia. So Movement for a New Society was based there, but it was a network that extended across the country. There were folks in Ann Arbor, Michigan, there were folks in Tucson, Arizona, there were people in Boston, there were people in Savannah, Georgia, etc. And it grew out of a Quaker group called a Quaker Action Group, which throughout the 60s had kind of tried to develop and continue the practice of radical pacifism. So it was a tradition that had long roots, but really had kind of grown in the United States in the 40s and 50s with the influence of Gandhi. And I'll say a few more things about that in a minute. When it became Movement for a New Society in 1971, the idea was for the small group to kind of get bigger and expand its politics past, it had been primarily fighting, resisting the war. But there was a lot of thinking kind of going on at that moment of how to expand efforts and at the same time avoid or correct for some of the problems that had come up with movements of the 60s. So one of the things they wanted to do was really try to bring in a whole bunch of these kind of new critiques and ideas that were coming up. One around feminism, eventually around homophobia, also really around ecology and think about the environment, to really think about some of the relationship between the United States and the Third World in terms of how resources were distributed. So the kind of analysis had to grow and change. But at the same time, there was a sense of wanting to grow and change how we went about doing our work and how we did our politics. They were really running into the sense of burnout that was becoming rampant. Burnout just from activists from the 60s kind of being involved day in and day out of organizing demonstrations and doing fundraisers and showing up at the meeting and putting out the newspaper. And also just the kind of sense of the huge level of repression that was coming down at that time. So one thing that Movement for a New Society wanted to do was to try to think about ways that we could do organizing and activism and confront all these sources of domination and power and inequality that needed to be confronted, but also try to take care of the activists themselves a little bit more. How to do that work and create more of a supportive community so that people could kind of be in it for the long haul. They also had this other idea that they really drew from the kind of pacifist tradition, which was that they wanted, that they thought that we should live the revolution now. That was a kind of big phrase that they put forward. In a way, it was a reformulation of Gandhi's idea of become the change that you want to see. In a way, it also was a reformulation of anarchist ideas, especially those coming from people like Gustav Landauer. There's a book of Gustav Landauer's writings that was just published recently, and he talks about beginning. How are we going to make socialism? We're going to begin by creating socialist settlements or colonies. We're going to begin by creating economic relations that are non-capitalist. We need to leave the state rather than smash the state. Movement for a New Society wanted to do both. They wanted to start living the revolution now, and they wanted to figure out ways of creating massive non-violent movements that essentially could paralyze the state by having enough people withdraw their consent and their participation in daily life all at the same time. So these were two things that they had to try and keep in balance. They called the adversarial and the exemplary, right? So there's a lot to be said about Movement for New Society, but let me get to prison and let me talk about two moments in thinking about prison. When I tried to piece together how it was that this radical pacifist organization developed a lot of some of the kind of techniques and methods that informed anarchist politics three decades later, I had to trace back a little bit and think about radical pacifism historically. And there's an earlier moment where pacifism and anarchism come together in U.S. history. And that's the moment of World War II. And not a lot has been kind of, I think, really written about this kind of encounter, but it's significant. In the days, the year or so leading up to World War II, the small group of anarchists that were left in the United States and that were still, I would say, were much closer to that tradition of kind of Emma Goldman's anarchism that I invoked earlier, decided how they were going to kind of, what stand they were going to take or what position they take regarding World War II. The majority of them decided that, kind of practically speaking, they had to side with the United States and the Allies in supporting the kind of state-based fight against fascism, against the Axis powers. People like Rudolf Rocker were really influential in supporting that. A smaller group, especially some of the Italian, more insurrectionist type of anarchists, decided that, you know, we've always been opposed to war, we've always been opposed to imperialism. This is another example of a kind of inter-imperialist war. The United States isn't really against fascism. They let Hitler and Mussolini come to power because of the ways that those regimes were useful in suppressing the left and suppressing communism and other forms of socialism in Europe. And so we don't even really trust them that what they're doing is fighting fascism. We think that in fighting totalitarianism, the United States is becoming more totalitarianism with the draft, for example. So there was a small group of anarchists that decided, like no matter how terrible Hitler is, we're going to resist the draft, we're going to resist the war. And a bunch of them got thrown in prison because of that. Some of them, they had the opportunity to register as conscientious objectors or to try to kind of obtain conscientious objector status and be put in these kind of work camps that were set up, especially for religious pacifists. And a few of them ended up there, but a lot of them didn't qualify because they had to be religious-based conscientious objectors, and they were atheists. They were just like, were politically opposed to the war. So some of them ended up in prison. Interestingly enough, who else ended up in prison? A bunch of kind of Gandhian-inspired, but mostly religious pacifists. groups that of people that had been involved with the War Resisters League, which Matt has been involved with for a long time, and with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, a group that AJ Musty was kind of chair of. And so in this encounter, there were, these people found each other. They are often sent to the same prisons, like Danbury Federal Corrections Institution in Connecticut. And so there were anarchists and there were radical pacifists, and they kind of found each other, and they also realized that there was segregation in the federal prisons, not too surprising for 1940, but the cafeterias were segregated, the barber shops in the prisons were segregated, the cells that people were put in were segregated, and there were these kind of politicized war resistors there, and they came together around resistance to that form of segregation. There was an amazing set of strikes that went on in the prisons across the country, and those were actually quite successful in ending segregation in some of the prisons and in liberalizing a lot of the policies. So the kind of lockdown and the tampering, the kind of censorship of mail, other things like that were kind of rolled back by the kind of concerted action, nonviolent direct action, inspired by the example of Gandhi in India, of this group, these anarchists and these pacifists. And they were hanging out and had a lot of time to do nothing. So they were talking with each other and kind of shooting ideas around. I saw some great letters from one of the anarchists, a guy named David Thoreau Week, who talks about, we have these, he's writing his mom, he's like, "Don't worry about us, Mom, we're having a great time here. We keep trying," what does he say? He says, the kind of Christians keep trying to hang a beard on us and we try to shave their beard. And they're talking about God as this like bearded figure, right? And so shaving the beard is to make the Christians atheists, and the Christians are trying to show like the kind of radical roots of Christian thought, so they're hanging a beard on the atheists and stuff like that. So there's a actually fascinating exchange of ideas going on. And this was a because of the segregation going on, to some extent, these were kind of multiracial encounters. There were people, there were white pacifists like David Dellinger, kind of key figure involved, and there were African-American pacifists like Bayard Rustin and Bill Sutherland that were kind of locked up at this time. After the war ended and these folks got out, they were invigorated by that experience of actually gaining some victories, if small victories, within the prison system. And they kind of started conceiving of a new radical politics that they called revolutionary nonviolence. And within that kind of politics, there was a strong anarchist pacifist strain. People like Dellinger, like Bill Sutherland, like David Thoreau Week, like a guy named Igal Rudenko, Ralph DeGia, who was another longtime War Resisters League member and staff person, identified as anarchists, while there were also a lot of socialist, kind of more democratic state socialist folks involved at that time. So they were really ready to go gangbusters to kind of create this radical nonviolence movement that they would see as opposing war, racism, capitalism, etc. But they ran into the kind of stark reality of Cold War America, and they didn't get very far in that. However, I would argue that these were some of the folks that were most active in the 40s and 50s, and that kind of informed a lot of the kind of early New Left organizing as well as civil rights organizing in the South, and brought some of the ideas of direct action and nonviolent direct action, kind of interracial organizing, to the kind of early 60s moments. So then we fast forward to the 70s, Movement for a New Society. Movement for a New Society kind of picks up on this radical pacifist tradition, and there's some kind of resurgent movement of anarchism, coming out of the late 60s, and some of those people filter in and make connections with Movement for a New Society. People in the Clamshell Alliance, people around Murray Bookchin Institute for Social Ecology, people around a journal in Boston called The Raven. And there was another moment where this kind of active incarceration or experience of incarceration was also really kind of politically explosive. And that was around the Seabrook nuclear power plant demonstrations. In the mid-1970s, there was this kind of expansion of the nuclear power industry. And it was something that a number of kind of strands of 60s activists could kind of regroup around opposing. Folks who are interested in ecology, people who saw the connections between nuclear weapons and nuclear power development, and so we're opposed to war, etc., decided that they wanted to stop the expansion of the nuclear power industry. And one place that they came together was in Seabrook, New Hampshire, and they had a kind of a mass nonviolent direct action coordinated through this idea of the spokes council method, or what used to be called the small to large group decision-making process. That was something that was kind of introduced as an idea and a concept by members of Movement for a New Society. They got the idea, as they tell me, from some Swedish activists that had come over and hung out in Philadelphia and participated in their like 6-month training program in nonviolent action. They're like, this works pretty good for us over in Sweden. We've been trying to block the development of these highways. We have this method. And so they picked it up and it was introduced, and it worked really effectively in Seabrook. It worked so effectively that about 1,400 people were arrested, as they had intended to be, and they were held in these kind of armories, these large armories that were kind of spread around New Hampshire. What was interesting was that they had locked up all these folks who were fascinated with kind of with discussing like decision-making process and organizing and self-education. And so Movement for a New Society people and a number of other kind of allies close to them just turned this kind of 2-week long experience of being arrested into a movement building moment. They were all stuck there. They weren't going to do their jobs, to go to work. They had time to communicate. They had time to teach each other skills. And they kind of organized themselves into these affinity groups that were kind of self-directing. And so it became actually a really empowering experience. They decided to stay through kind of collective decision making, to stay instead of accepting bail and all getting bailed out, paying money. Eventually, some of them did, but they got out on their own terms. Is I think what was important. So this model was exciting, and it was picked up and it was used by other anti-nuke groups around the country, and that was the way that some of these principles, consensus, spokes councils, etc., really got spread and developed. And there was an institutional memory of that in the left when it came to organizing things like Seattle, or 4 years before the Seattle demonstrations, the active resistance kind of gathering in Chicago for the 1996 presidential elections, RNC. Before that, the kind of Gulf War won demonstrations. So this kind of model was picked up and transmitted through that time. And we can see these kind of two moments where acts of resistance were, in a sense, this is a different situation. It's activists that had elected essentially to go to prison based on their principles, or to go to jail based on their principles. Once there, had the kind of tools and the ideas and the capacity to collectively resist within the confines of being incarcerated, and that gave them enough of a boost of energy to kind of go out and create these new ways of doing politics that that are still with us today, for better or worse. I think a lot for better. And so I think that's a kind of a another take and interesting way of thinking about prison in the 70s. So yeah, that's a little bit about my chapter. You can read about the rest in the book. Thanks.
So Matt Meyer has joined us fashionably late. I don't know. Matt, do you want to say a little bit about your chapter?
You're not going to give me a big introduction, just fashionably late, that's all I got. I'm glad there's a, you know, I'm glad there's a microphone and a camera. I did wear my love beads to be like a little 70s-ish. So the one thing I could find that was 70s related this morning. So. Fashionably late. People did know I was going to be late. These people, some people, whether they told you or not, knew I was going to be late. So I do apologize for coming late, but it was an unavoidable prior meeting engagement that I had long had. I'm going to be really brief because I think it's getting late and it would be good for us to have some conversation. So I'm going to try to be very, very brief. And if I'm not, you can like start talking, cough, and, you know, try to leave the place. I'm really excited about being here tonight for a couple of reasons, aside from my esteemed colleagues who I like always seeing, even if we don't talk to each other, but about each other. But the two big reasons that I'm excited about being here, number one is I'm really excited to have this book out and New York events around this book, because I think one of the things that this book offers us, and I hope it hasn't been said already, that's the problem with being fashionably late, is I might be repeating something, but it bears repeating, that it's my analysis, it's my understanding that though we have volumes and volumes written about the 60s, we have yet to have a concise, single, or even short series of works that help us as a movement of the 21st century understand what that period of time known as the 60s was all about. Now, I'm really sorry that this book is not that volume either. But one of the problematics about understanding the 60s is that most of the works, even some of the better works, even some of the more honest works, and there's plenty of dishonest and disingenuous works that are filled with self-aggrandizing things written by the 60s from those people who allegedly lived in that period of time as more than just kids, which I was a little kid at that time. But aside from the dishonest ones, even the honest ones, even the better ones, look at that period of time with a sense of individual and personal memory, and really, it's unapologetically memoirist version of the world. They're not histories, and they're not written by historians, and they're certainly not written, they're written by activists at the time, but they're not written from a lens that I think can be usefully or easily translatable to movements of today. And I think what that does in large form, writ large, is it misunderstands the 60s as a period of time that lasted for about 10 years, from 1960 till the end of the 60s. When in fact anyone who really understands that decade, or I'm sorry, that period of time, first and foremost has to understand that the 60s started around 1954 and ended in the late 1970s. See, that's what the 60s were, 54 to the late 1970s. And that period of time that we conceptually think of as the 60s has that breadth of years. And this book contributes to that understanding. And that's one of the reasons I'm excited that we're here and that we have this book. Because the hidden radicalism, the hidden 70s and historical radicalism begins to complete, this book begins to complete, in my view, and thanks to Dan and my colleagues, begins to complete an understanding of the 60s and what it meant. Because it didn't end in 1969, you know, when the Beatles broke up and Weather Underground was formed and all those other good and bad things happened. I'm not sure which is good and which is bad. The second reason I'm really excited about being here is that I think as I think most people in this room know, so I won't belabor the point at all. No understanding of radicalism in this country, or any country for that matter, can be understood fully without understanding the role of prison. Political imprisonment and prison in general is fundamental to understanding the history of radicalism, both what the state threatens and falls through on those threats, and what people inside and outside do to respond to those threats are fundamental to understanding history of radicalism. So a lot more said by that by a number of us in other books we've written, and I think folks who work on both sides of the line and who work with the collective that helped put this together know this, so I'm not going to say more about that. But I can say a little more about prison work in regards to my chapter, and I guess that's all I'm going to do, and then shut up. So I don't have to say much about my chapter, because I think Andy already presented on my chapter. I mean, he wrote about Movement for a New Society. I wrote the chapter called Working for Nonviolent Revolution and a Pacifist Underground. But he already talked about Working for Nonviolent Revolution. So I think Andy gave you a lot of the information. But essentially, my chapter is called Hard to Find. And it's specifically looking at not the one organization, Movement for a New Society, that did come from an attempt at building for revolutionary nonviolence in the 70s, but the number of different, harder to find, hidden, and often forgotten pieces of the tip of the radical edge of the pacifist movement that in the 70s struggled to do something different than just be anti-war. Now that tip, in fact, is secret in part because one of their legacies was simple clandestinity. One of the things that some of those people did was go underground. Another thing that those folks did was opt out, was simply, you know, that Timothy Leary drop in, tune on, turn on, drop out. It was simply drop out. And it was not just always drop out because we, you know, were sick and tired of society as it was presented, but sometimes it was drop out because we felt like that was the most effective way of being a radical. Get off the grid, form a commune that doesn't interface with the state. Very grassroots anarchism. You know, it was not organizational anarchism, but it was also not liberal in any way. It was about a radical critique of the state and how we can disengage or de-link from it. And drop out also meant leaving the country. That clandestine tip also meant people who had to leave the country or felt like they had to because draft resistance pulled them in a direction northwards, mostly to Canada, but also because they felt like leaving the country was the thing to do at a time when the revolution wasn't happening. And though there could be some hopes among some sectors that the revolution was around the corner in the late 60s and early 70s, by the mid-70s, I think a lot of people thought, oh, well, that was not true, not happening. So while some groups were building clandestine fighting forces, some folks who were more into the pacifist side of things were just dropping out and moving clandestinely either out of the country or to these communes, or in some cases, and I'll talk a minute about this, in some cases to organize groupings that, though committed to nonviolence, were also committed to direct action to overthrow the state. Now, what about that last little grouping? Well, that last little grouping becomes very, very interesting to me, at least, because they start engaging in things that can only be termed property destruction. Okay, so what is property destruction? Well, what the Weather Underground did was property destruction, right? I mean, they didn't mainly go after people. They didn't go after so-called soft targets in military terms. They went after buildings, right? That's property, right? So, wait, the pacifists, they went after files, books. Well, that's property. So wait, the files, that's good property. We can destroy that. Pacifists do that. But big buildings, like, you know, bit windows, that's bad property. So we can't, if we go after that, we're violent. It becomes very tricky when you analyze something like weather and analyze something that, like, for example, the Berrigans, as the most famous example of folks who, you know, spent most of the 70s in these quasi-clandestine, quasi-underground movements, breaking into draft boards and destroying the files so that no draft resistor could be prosecuted. It wasn't just that, actually. People have heard of COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program that, you know, FBI program that went after from much before the 50s and even much before the 70s and even the 60s, but went after and targeted radical and progressive activists. You know, thank God COINTELPRO doesn't exist anymore and the FBI is no longer going after activists. But anyway, the initial group of folks who helped discover the thing called COINTELPRO, when they uncovered that there was this thing called the counterintelligence program, and these are the papers that documented, after fairly studiously Xeroxing those papers, then also set them alight and destroyed them, that was a group from the, as far as we can tell, from the pacifist edge of this clandestine movement of the 70s. So we have these little groupings, hard to find, and not often discussed in the radical histories, often in many cases dialoguing with the violent groupings, with the armed groupings, groups like Weather and groups in the Black and Puerto Rican movements. And in general, I think, when I think about revolutionary nonviolence, and I think about some of the people, heroes and sheroes, you mentioned a lot of guys, Barbara Deming has got to also be mentioned. If you're going to mention the guys, mention some of the women as well. But the folks who not only, you know, theoretically helped construct what revolutionary nonviolence might look like, as opposed to the liberal variety, but also really were working in a way, maybe not organizationally unified, but certainly understanding a movement that needed to be unified in a much less dichotomized way, in a much more unified, united way than what we currently have left. Because if the right and the state understood anything about their lessons of the 60s, that period from the mid-50s through the late 70s, they understood we've got to keep the good pacifists and the bad armed struggle people separate. We've got to keep the bad anarchists and the good social democrats separate. We've got to keep the good whites and the bad black and Latinos separate. We've got to keep people's identities separate. Because if they unite, who knows what we could do.
Probably going to have questions now, but I wanted to say something about the filming. If people would like to ask a question but they don't want to be filmed, just signal Steve and he'll put the camera on pause, okay? So nobody needs to be filmed necessarily.
Who gets to be like Oprah or Phil Dine?
Hello. So we'll have some time for questions and then plenty of time for book buying. If you don't have thoughts, questions, comments?
I can start. Nobody wants to jump in. Matt and Andy both brought up the idea of groups sort of separating themselves from society. You were also talking about a group that was politically active, but you mentioned the idea of, like, let's create an ideal society. And that's something that, like, I already had an idea that I associated that with the 1970s, because when I was in library school, I studied Liberation News Service, which is this amazing, like, amalgamating program of radical news that was just so politically important in the late 60s. And a whole bunch of them split in 1970 to take off to live on a commune. And because they had a lot of political renown, it became almost a model for so many other groups in right around the beginning of the 70s to sort of do the back to the land movement. And it's something that I always figured was regressive, you know? So I'm wondering if that's like a formation of a model society, or that was the intent, and people were working through those issues. What do you see the legacy of the back to the land movement and the separation into communes being? Like, looking at it now, and some of those groups even managed to last all this time. Like, I know there's one in Tennessee that still exists, the Farm.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyone want to comment on that?
I'll say really quickly. It's a mishmash, because the legacy is extremely mixed, huh? Because literally you have some folks that did it in a very individualistic and self-serving way. Those tend to last less long, but not always. If you had a group of people that was particularly tight with one another, some of them lasted quite a while. But you also have, I think there was a cultural shift there. And some of that could be co-opted because it wasn't as directly threatening. You know, there are parts of the health food and organic and holistic movements, you know, the Whole Life Expo movements that grew, you know, closely out of some of those things. But then you have other things that are much more complicated, that have in some ways a much more potentially positive legacy. The farm is an interesting example because you have a huge midwifery movement that really is sustained and given both some prominence and some logistical support from out of the work that was, you know, emanating from the farm folks in Tennessee. But it's a mixed legacy, I would say, because you do have some folks that were looking at it very explicitly progressive, and many others that were not. I don't know if that begins to answer your question.
I'll say something too.
I think the mixed legacy of that idea of forming communes and living the revolution now, trying to prefigure the social relations that would hopefully comprise the new society that the movements were fighting for. That set of ideas was one of the things that eventually led to the demise of Movement for a New Society. The kind of contradictory understandings or emphases that different participants placed on that those ideas led to a lot of tension and eventually a kind of dissolution of this group. So it's really pretty interesting trying to talk with some of these folks that were involved in some of these projects about their evaluation of that. Some of the initial founders of Movement for a New Society told me about why they had this idea basically of having urban communes in a way, buying these kind of big old houses that they could buy pretty cheaply, live in with like 6-10 people, and not have to pay much rent on. Initially, this was an idea of just a way of pooling resources, so they didn't have to work so much, so they didn't have to do so much fundraising, so they could spend more time getting involved, you know, doing their political work, doing the thinking, doing the organizing, etc. And at the same time, do this kind of work of supporting one another, of doing the kind of thinking that they needed to do around some of their own ideas of about, you know, sexism, racism, classism, etc. But the idea wasn't that if we form it, they will come. If we make it, people will come. This kind of old utopian socialist idea of let's set up the commune and it's going to be so amazing and brilliant and beautiful and egalitarian that everyone else will just naturally see that this is a much superior way to live our lives, and we'll want to move there themselves or start their own. That was not the initial idea with the people I'm talking about, but eventually, over the course of the decade, it started to become the idea. And so there was a kind of confusion there. And I read a quote when we had a little book talk last night that speaks right to this. I'll just read this one quote. One of the founding members, George Lakey, remembers encountering newcomers to the Life Center. That was the area of Philadelphia that Movement for New Society was living in the mid-70s, who saw it as another intentional community and wanted lifestyle to be the leading edge of change. He said that he had to explain to them that, quote, the cutting edge of our understanding of revolution is not lifestyle change. We think of it like ashrams and Gandhi's ideas, which were base camps for revolution. So what do you do in the base camp for revolution? You get ready to go to the barricades. But these kind of ideas about, you know, if we create it, it'll be a beacon to others, versus if we create it, we'll be more sustained in our fight against the state, against capitalism, etc. We're in tension, and I think in a lot of the communities, even from the early 70s, it was more the former than the latter. And I think that what we have seen is not just in that period, but much more, last couple hundred years, that it's not enough to try and create these communities of resistance and these prefigurative communities. because they're not seen, they're not attractive enough on their own. But there is some potential for community in supporting that kind of adversarial work that also needs to happen.
Yeah. I'll just add a little bit that, you know, there was a whole other tendency of people that were looking to the land, not in a commune sense, which is groups like the Republic of New Africa and the American Indian Movement and others, you know, in the Puerto Rican Independence Movement and in the Chicano Movement, who were looking to, you know, reclaim stolen land. And, you know, the RNAs moved to Mississippi, Ames moved to and work with various reservations and other regions across the country. It was, I think, another sort of parallel turn to the land that was in the 70s that had a revolutionary thrust that was a part of, a specific challenge to the settler colonialism that was also a sort of turn to the land. That is also sort of part of the hidden 70s, right? That sort of land emphasis is not just the like hippie dropout types. Other questions, thoughts?
I have a question about you mentioned these groups from the 70s inspiring the last 10 years of anti-prison work. Are there sort of direct links in terms of people involved in those movements, or how did that influence get?
Sure. I mean, the sort of obvious example would be Angela Davis, again, given her role in helping start critical resistance in 98, but also several people who were organizers at that time, including people that were doing prison work at that time, were involved in starting CR, along with a crop of younger folks who weren't alive at that time. There are few organizational lineages that last, but I think there are a lot of folks who have been doing prison work for a really long time, and many of them have done it in different ways, right? They were prisoners and now they're organizing other formerly incarcerated people, or they were doing prison work and found themselves in prison, and that's where they continue to do their work now. I don't know if Vicky, you want to add to that?
There are some of the women that did work for some of the women that did work around like Inez Garcia's case or Joanne Little's case, then went on to do work around women's incarceration issues in North Carolina. Like, there was a tremendous outpouring of support around Joanne Little's case, and these women then went on to work with women who were incarcerated at the women's prison in Raleigh and did support for them, especially when they had their riot and their uprising, and they continued to work with them past after that to make sure that there was retaliation, but that there wasn't like extreme retaliation against them, because there were outside supporters and people doing that, and they've left documentation of what's gone on. One of the women who did support for Inez Garcia, a woman named Diana Block, got involved with like the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and several other people from that generation of women who weren't necessarily doing prisoner support work at the time, like, in the 90s and early 2000s, started doing work specifically around the issue of women's incarceration. So there are some ties, there it's not necessarily a like trajectory that you can be like, they did A and then they did B and then they did C. You know, people come to this kind of work or they come back to this work in different ways. No other questions, really?
We kind of got one. I was wondering if anybody y'all interviewed had any comments about the new terror-enhanced sentences and laws and how that might change prison work for, like, I'm thinking specifically for activists right now, but it seems like the definition broadens every time you read about it. So, I mean, what do people that organize, that were organizing back then, like, what do they think about what's going on now?
Maybe. Good stuff in the chapter about the sort of nonprofit side, which is a different angle of it. But
why don't we start?
I mean, that's sort of outside the purview of the book, or at least my own particular essay in it. But certainly the expanse and the expansive nature of the prison industrial complex is and of state repression in general is a terrifying thing, and I think we've seen many examples that by which they've targeted activists and organizers. Perhaps most recently the FBI raids in Minneapolis and Chicago and North Carolina. And I think the, you know, one of the parallels is, you know, I was talking about the successful examples in the 70s of groups sort of being broad and trying to incorporate a lot of people, but that was against a lot of resistance, particularly for those people who were facing charges for anything having to do with violence. There were a whole lot of people who consider themselves progressives or on the left who didn't want to have anything to do with anyone who was charged with violence in any way. And so that enabled the state to do what Matt was talking about and create those divisions. And I think, you know, at that time it was, you know, a communist was sort of the worst smear you could have on someone. But in the 70s, you start to see the use of the T word being that divisive element, right? And in the 80s in particular, those folks who were continued, you know, clandestine armed work in the 80s and were arrested, it was exactly the sort of prototype of a war on terror, right? And these were dangerous terrorists who needed to be locked up, and large chunks of the left, much less other people, didn't want to have anything to do with those folks. And they became the guinea pigs for control units and all of the, you know, super repressive measures, even within the prison, that separated prisoners from other prisoners. Right, and those sort of prisons within a prison, and the enhanced restrictions on mail, on literature, right, all the things that the prisoner rights movement in the 70s fought for started to be rolled back by the sort of early war on terror, right, against left-wing radicals, and also the war on gangs, which was a sort of code word, much like the war on drugs, for going after young black and Latino men, essentially, right, and both of those cases, targeting them on the street and even once they got inside. And California has sort of led the way with their massive gang database and sort of gang profile system. And so I think, right, starting in the 70s and all the way through and beyond September 11th, any chance the state has had to expand its net to, you know, create those divisions and lock people up, it's used. And I think the power of mass movements and broad radical or left unity has slowed it down. And where that hasn't existed, they've had tremendous successes on our behalf.
Yeah. If I can add to that, I think in prison activism, the increasing use of isolation and shoes, like solitary housing units and IMUs and stuff like that have put a lot of activists in a position where they're always fighting some new repressive measure if they're prison activists, as opposed to actually trying to create new programs and get things into the prisons. Like, I read a really good book, which if someone wants to hold that up over there, The Rise and Fall of California's Radical Prison Movement. It describes a lot of the programs that started in the 70s in California where people were trying to get reading groups and stuff into the facilities, and it's amazing by today's standards what they got away with. At the time it seemed normal, you know, and there's stuff in the new book about the George Jackson Brigade about the films they were able to get in and show in jails and stuff like that, and these days it seems kind of crazy, but it's because we've been put in this position where we're always trying to like keep things from becoming less awful, you know? Like, a lot of the prison activists I know right now are fighting CMUs, some of them are fighting to, like, improve terrible health care in prison, or terrible food, or whatever. So it's like the system seems to understand how to keep us backing up, like, continually backing up. I don't know if that's just, like, the pessimism of having worked in this era and not that one, and they really felt that way back then, but that's the impression I get.
I'm sorry, I'm looking at books while I'm also engaged in the conversation. No, I don't think it's just the thing about... I'm in the drama section now. I don't think it's just about this era or that, although I think it's really important not to get too bogged down in pessimism. I mean, you know, Dave Dellinger, who I learned a lot from directly, in the 80s, talked about how the movements of the 80s and 90s, I think he would have said the same thing about today, are much stronger than the movements of the 60s ever were, and I would have said the same thing about the 70s, I think. What we don't have, the luxury of that, what the state did learn, and we haven't quite caught up in the reverse, is that one big united movement, the war in Vietnam, the anti-war movement, what's happening in the South, the civil rights and black liberation movement, that never again will, the media be allowed to, or the state be structured such that a unified movement around a unified theme can develop. But if you take all of the grassroots groups, all of the little things, all of the little book clubs here and bookstores there, independent bookstores there, all the little anarchist groups, all the little, if you put them all together, it's many, many more people in organized groupings than at the height of the anti-war movement. So that was an important way of thinking of things, as I've been trying to think of things all my life and not get depressed. But I do think what we're facing now, back to your question, I think what we're facing now is all of the intensity of the repression, maybe not at the height of the 70s, but getting close, without the excitement of coming off of a wave of movement like the 60s. So we're facing the repression without that sense of a vibrant and successful movement. And how do we deal with that? How do we deal with this moment? Because I think this moment's going to... I think things are not going to get better in the next 10 years. I think it's going to get more intense, right? I think the repression's going to get worse, frankly. And we have to look to the 70s for what some of that worse is going to look like. And I also think at the same time, part of it's getting worse is about the empire crumbling. So the opportunities are going to be there for us. Not on a silver platter and not happening just because they have to happen. But I think the opportunity is going to be there. So we have to figure out how to organize. And the only clue I have, if I knew the answer, that would be a different book and we'd have more people, whatever. But I think one of the clues, one of the discussions that we have to have, to me, are about short bursts. Yeah, there's not going to be a war. It does boggle my mind how long Afghanistan and Iraq have continue. That I haven't really figured out how, because that's been maintained for a long time, much longer than I would have expected. But I think what we have and what we're going to have are short bursts. I was surprised, but not so much so, to see the stuff about the FBI and the grand jury resistance this morning, right? People heard that essentially some of the folks who decided they would not go to the grand jury in Chicago, they would not go. That doesn't seem like they're going after them, right? That was the latest thing today. It's not clear that some of those subpoenas were actually canceled. Is that what happened this morning? Something happened, I believe, and I hope I'm not getting this totally wrong, but I'm getting it slightly right at least. Some of the subpoenas to grand juries that some of those folks had been served a week or two ago, and they were supposed to show up, I think, on Monday, and they didn't show up, and those subpoenas have been canceled as of sometime this morning. So there are these strange little... And these are for the anti-war activists, and it's not going to be the same thing for other activists. But there are these strange little windows, these strange little bursts, where there's going to be a burst of repression and then a little step back. And I think we have to do our activism accordingly. We have to make a burst, because doing a sustained big campaign may not work. We may not be able to have that time. But I think those bursts of action, those bursts of movement, those bursts of unified activity around a campaign, maybe the way we have to look at the next 5 or 10 years of organizing. That's a clue. It's not an answer, but it's a question and it's a worry, because I think what you're describing about the intensity of the repression and about the sort of negative energy that we haven't, we're not dealing with the repression in a particularly good climate, are not just not having been back in the days. There is something about this period and about where the empire is at and what it needs to do to grapple on to its last sort of last moments.
Maybe one more question? Or we can end with the crumbling of empire.
The grappling and the crumbling.
Yeah, grappling and the crumbling. Great, well, so why don't we stop there and we're sort of around informally if people want to chat. We have several books for sale for $20, benefiting Books Through Bars, and also a couple of copies of Upping the Ante, which is an anti-capitalist journal from Canada. And thank you all very much. This is great.